week on the Reflex Blue Show, Ben Luters concludes his journey of Design Camp with an interview with Eric Madsen. Next week, we'll return with reviews of football game advertisement.
Welcome back to the Reflex Blue Show. I'm your host, Ben Luters, and I am joined today by Eric Madsen. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're welcome, Ben.
We're shaking hands right now.
Yes. Can you see it?
Can you see it? So, Eric, I got to say, I sat down to lunch yesterday, and I was joined by all kinds of great designers, but most of them I didn't know and I didn't recognize. Of course, I recognized Paula Scher, who I had interviewed the night before, but you were sitting right across from me, and I started to get to know you a little bit, and I didn't realize that you were the guy that was about to give a keynote right after lunch. And I started asking you some questions about where you came from, how you ended up in Minneapolis, and kind of basically the story of your life. And you kind of stopped me, and you were like, are you going to hear my talk in a few minutes? And I was like, crap, I better, you know? And he's like, just wait. And so I go to your talk, and I think, like everybody that went to your talk, I was blown away, you know, by your story. And that's what you shared. It wasn't... You didn't present, in stark contrast from a lot of other people's presentations, it's kind of, here's a project, and here's a, you know, that I did, and here's the process, and that's very helpful, and I've really enjoyed it, enjoyed Paula Scher doing that. But you just kind of gave us a story of your entire life, basically, and that was so helpful, because I think anybody can relate to a story, and one of the things I'm passionate about, and that I'm trying to glean from some of these designers that have been around a few years longer than I have, is design as a lifestyle. And I can't think, after hearing your talk, I can't think of anybody better to talk about that. So let's talk about that.
Fine, Ben.
Eric.
And I think you need to tell them that at lunch they served turkey and most of the audience was asleep. So.
We were a little sleepy, but I tell you woke us up. I think you got everybody to cry, and you got a standing ovation, and you earned it. So.
Oh, yeah, it was very touching. I was so moved.
Well, obviously. Yeah. Eric.
I was moved.
So tell me, design as a lifestyle. Can you kind of share a little bit of your talk with us on the podcast for those of us who weren't able to hear it?
Well, I think for this talk, Ben, my thoughts were that I decided that there probably might be people in the audience who had gone through a similar situation I'd gone through growing up in the 50s maybe or the 60s, even though they're so much younger, but maybe having had that similar experience of discovering, oh my gosh, at this early age I have this ability to maybe draw something or to create something, but no, I was not in an environment or an era that really promoted it or fostered it, or there were mentors. And I also probably should explain that I grew up on a ranch in the Texas Panhandle, so, and it was in the 50s and in the early 60s, and at that time and in that environment, as you saw, and the listeners haven't seen, but as you saw, I did not have art classes or mentors or role models or anything like that. So I basically set that aside after a point in time, realizing that there seemed to be no viable direction for it. Happily for me, you know, I was able to go to the University of Houston later, even though I was pre-med starting, and discovered art at a major university. Luckily, there was a major art department, and that's really, I think, the first time that I realized maybe those early abilities to do something with art could actually be, I could act on them, because there was a faculty, there were courses, and so I changed my major from medicine to art, as I said to the crowd.
Right.
But and I think, just to back up, I think in structuring the talk, I felt that it was important maybe to explain how confused I was, and you know. the uncertainty about this talent, or this maybe just, I would say, raw talent, or this love of drawing more than anything, and in the hopes that maybe there were some young designers in the audience who could say, yeah, I had those same things, so then maybe what I'm doing now in the courses that I'm in, or, you know, whatever, is that I'm on that same set of tracks, or I'm on that same road. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, there's something that I can do with this. I can see that not everybody is born right into the right environment. You know, it's interesting. I think you mentioned Paula, but I think of if I had been born in a major metropolitan city or area like New York or L.A. or one of them in those days, I think discovering art, number one, would not have been difficult at all. Discovering even the early profession that we now call graphic design or design, which might have been not labeled that in that era, might have not been so hard. You know, in other words, it might have been clearer to me because when you think of commerce and everything that happens in those environments, they all need, you know, that kind of service, even right. back then, even though in my environment, as I mentioned in the talk, most of what I experienced and what I know now to have been something that I would loosely use the term design was done by a printer, you know, so
right, with the business cards that you showed.
Yeah, the business cards that I did when Ron and I were folk singing. But it never dawned on me that I would ever have, at some point in my life, the ability or the capability of actually creating a custom business card. It was, I just remember the day we walked in this print shop, and he just said, you want this style, you want this style, or this style?
Right.
Yeah, we said, well, we'll take that one, you know? And you saw the letter spacing. And
I mean,
you could drive a car through all of those letters, and different. Right. There were three different fonts on the card. And
at that time, did you look at the card and were
no.
you like...
Oh, no, no.
Like, oh, man,
no.
that needs to be
no.
kerned a little bit? Or
no, not at all. Not at all.
No.
Never dawned on me. No.
Wow.
But if there'd have been a draw, if he'd put a drawing of something on it,
yeah.
you know, that might have stopped me, because that was something that, as I presented in my talk,
yeah.
that love of drawing was something
yeah.
that it preceded this whole career,
oh.
mini career in music. But no, it did not dawn on me, Ben. No, not even remotely in that era. No, We were dead set on becoming the next Simon and Garfunkel.
And those were the two things that really resonated with me in your talk, were your love of drawing and your sharing your personal drawings with the group, and also your love of music. Those are things that are very important to me. So I started out, you know, wanting to make it as a musician and everything. We just had a little conversation before the podcast and how a lot of Eric's idols of, you know, Simon and Garfunkel and John Denver, which you actually knew.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
As a personal friend. Unbelievable. I just want to touch you right now.
Well.
You know, and that's kind of how I started. So that was a big part of my own life. And music is still such an important outlet to me. So I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about that, is how I know that you shared these sketches and they're so beautiful. I can't believe your attention to detail. That, you know, and I hope we can maybe put some of these up on the blog post when we do this, show some of these pictures that he's done. But is music still an outlet of yours? I saw you collect some Martin guitars.
Yes.
I'm a Taylor guy, but okay. Martins
Taylor's
are good too.
Nice, nice.
Yeah,
hey, don't.
I just bought some Martin strings, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll see. I'm trying. I used the Dario's, but that's
okay.
Fine. No problem. Listen, you do not have to apologize for Taylor. You know, Taylor is a great guitar company.
No,
I know
it. I went back and forth between. I finally decided I'm going to buy a guitar that wasn't a $300 guitar one day. You know, had to make that one step up. And I just sat there going between the certain Martin and the certain Taylor. Just went back and forth and back and forth. They're both great instruments.
Yeah.
And my wife was there with me, and she just helped me. And I think with my sound, The Taylor just was the better bet, but Martin's a beautiful
guitar. Are you a fingerstyle player or a flat picker?
I do it both ways.
Do you?
I do all kinds of different stuff. Yeah. What about yourself?
I play fingerstyle, so I like the smaller body Martins. And mm-hmm. But when I've played smaller body Taylors, I'm equally impressed. But I think they are another great, you know, great luthier. They're manufacturer.
Right.
Luthier would be a smaller scale. A guitar I play a lot now is a guitar called Collings. It's made
absolutely.
You know Bill Collings in
absolutely.
Austin. And
a friend of mine works down there. Yeah.
No kidding. Yeah. I went to Austin one time with Dougal Sturmer, actually.
Oh.
And
I'd love to talk more about him.
We were down there together, and we had some custom cowboy boots made, and then we went over and had lunch with Bill Collings. And
unbelievable.
We each bought a guitar, and believe it or not, even though I have this collection of Martins, and Dougal did as well, we each ended up buying Collings, and I actually play that guitar quite a bit. Yeah.
Fantastic guitar.
Because it's a smaller size. It would be comparable to like a 00 size body size in Martin. So it's perfect for a finger picker, you know. And still has the long scale on the neck, but it's the body's small enough that I can hold it more easily. Yeah, yeah.
So do you compose your own music and play around stuff?
Yeah, I still do. I play every day, only for myself and.
Only for yourself. Do you ever perform or record or anything?
No,
share?
Not anymore.
Oh my goodness. I need to bring my podcast down there and record you with it. It'll sound great.
Well, no, I got to get my chops back up if I was ever going to do that. But I think, we were talking at the Q&A after my talk, I think somebody asked about music, and I think you can identify with this, but I think once we seem as designers to... I won't generalize, but I'll just make it personal. Once I started to focus on design, then I realized all the hours that I would normally be woodshedding and trying to get keep my chops up and play was now going into building a career and running a company. And so I gave it 110%, and the guitar kind of became a stepchild to... Although the love of music, like in yourself, which I think is just great that we share that, that will never leave us. And because I've always believed that music is the biggest language that we share on this planet. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world and you'll find that culture, that society, that, you know, whatever, they have music.
Absolutely.
You know, they have art, but music is...
It's more fundamental.
And if you don't think it's great, then go to a movie and just leave the soundtrack off. You know, I mean, just what it brings to a movie.
I heard that George Lucas played the first Star Wars movie to some investors, the first cut, without any music to it, and to see kind of what their reaction. They all hated it. It was the worst thing ever. So we had John Williams do the soundtrack, now it's like the most amazing thing ever.
I love that story.
Think about it, you know.
I mean, just look at Dances with Wolves, you know. I mean, I love it, you know. Going across that prairie and everything, but I tell you, when that's John Williams as well, you know, and you start, I believe it's John Williams.
I'll have to fact check that. If not, we're going to have to cut that part out of the podcast.
We'll cut it out. I
know Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, he's done so much for me. Okay.
But I think it is, you know, that movement. Yeah. And but anyway, I didn't mean to digress, but I just think that I know I never let go of it. But I also know people in our profession who have kept their chops up and still gig and still play on a fairly regular basis.
I'm trying to get back into it. You know, it's funny. It was like that for me, too, where, you know, I really tried pursuing both at the same time.
Yeah.
But the more that I really got into design and stuff and I was trying to ramp up my own business, it was like, it was hard. You know, and then I got married and you have a kid and then things happen. And so, like, you know, it's hard to, you know, something's got to go. And so a lot of it was music, but... Still, at the end of the day, when I come home from a long day of work, I sit down at the piano. You know, I sing. I, you know, grab a guitar. I don't write as much as I used to, but I need to.
Yeah.
And I think knowing that you know, you gotta having that in the back of your head that, you know, this is still part of you.
Well,
you know?
I think it's also. I was just having this conversation yesterday with Chip Kidd, who's here.
Yeah.
And Chip has this experience as a drummer.
What?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah. But we were having this conversation, and we both kind of agreed that I think that there, at some point...
I'm just trying to picture Chip as a drummer.
I know.
He doesn't look the part
imagine?
To me.
Yeah, I know.
Trying to think, what part of the band is Chip?
I know. What a great guy. But
he gave a very different talk than you did, by the way.
Yeah, I did, but still
but nonetheless,
great.
Yeah, wonderful.
But the thing that we were talking about was that at some point, probably, and you can identify with this, is that there's this economic piece that comes into the equation.
It really does.
And music... I showed that slide about my kind of metaphor for the Great Pyramid of Music, but unless, you know, you suddenly had a revenue stream and you can support yourself at that point when you're also starting to make that decision whether it's going to be design or music as full-time, you know, what I saw was... once I got that job, that first job in Houston, and realized, oh my gosh, I've got a great job. I'm in a good firm. You know, the salary, which would be laughable if I even mentioned what it was, but I mean, still, in those days, I was thrilled, and I realized already I'm making more than I was folk singing yet. But I hated to let go of that.
Oh, I know.
You know. And the commitment, I mentioned that, you know, you mentioned, you know, John Denver. We knew him before. We knew him as John Dutchendorf.
I forget that. Was his
His friends really? Called him Dutch. But I remember the night that we were on a program together, and his trio, because he was an architectural studies major at Texas Tech just down the road from us.
I did not know that.
But I remember the night that we were backstage, and he told Ron and I, he said, I'm going to drop out of Texas Tech, and I'm going to go to the West Coast and see if I can make it. And I didn't get into this in my talk because I was afraid I was going to be even running too long as it was, but what I was going to say
Say it here.
What I was going to say is that in the mid-60s, early 60s, when we knew him and we were playing... the only way to make it in music was to say, it's going to be music, it's not going to be school. We're dropping out, like he did. And I, you know, Ron and I talked about it, and I remember saying to Ron, I don't know about you, but I don't have the guts to tell my parents that I'm dropping out of school and pursuing this field. It was maybe... It may have been that my feelings about being such a responsible child or trying to make something of myself in their eyes was keeping me in school, and that but what John did was what had to be done in those days. In other words, you had to actually get out and start doing it, and he had so much charisma. Had such a magnetic personality that when he was in that trio, you really didn't look at the other two guys much. Your eyes would not
really
drift from him because he had this magnetic smile. He was
true.
He just absolutely, his personality just reached right out into that audience and grabbed you. And I think he was also, like Simon said today in his talk,
which I missed.
Simon Collusion.
Yeah,
he said being in the right place at the right time. You know, John got to the West Coast. Chad Mitchell had a trio called the Chad Mitchell Trio. Chad left the trio. John Denver. John got there, changed his name to John Denver. Took Chad Mitchell's place. It became the Mitchell Trio. And then he wrote, I think the way it worked was, because then we kind of lost contact with John, but I think the way it worked was that he wrote Leaving on a Jet Plane, and Peter, Paul, and Mary picked it up. And then once he got that revenue
that the order
stream,
there?
Well, I think so. This might need some fact checking as well. But, you know, because once he left Texas, we kind of lost touch with him. The next thing we knew, he'd spent a little bit of time in the Mitchell Trio. And then I think as a result of the success of some of his own songwriting being covered by acts like Peter, Paul, and Mary, because he started writing such great material, I think he suddenly had a revenue stream to a point where he could go solo, and he did. And the rest is history. He's one of the probably one of the single largest or greatest success stories of the 70s in music that there was.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you think he almost kind of owned the 70s from a, you know, just a music generation, income producing kind of thing, you know. So,
absolutely.
So I think for you and I, you know, we may share that, but it's like you reach that point where you say, okay, the road is we got a fork of the road here, so do I pursue something I love, which
and
is
the
music?
Revenue does make a difference.
Yeah, and really for me, it was, I knew I had to start earning an income.
Yeah. Absolutely, and supporting a family.
Yeah,
and all
exactly.
That. The responsible thing.
And those things, and so.
And but design is still a bucket of fun, you know.
Oh.
It's great. You know what I mean? It's,
if it wasn't, we wouldn't have stayed in it for
yeah,
all these years.
Exactly.
Or, yeah, exactly.
But I mean, I think that was the thing is that I was for a while there. I always loved to draw. You talk to my parents and stuff. I mean, they were saying I was always drawing pictures. They thought I'd be an artist too. But I always thought that was the field that you couldn't make any money on. So I thought I was putting it all in this music thing. And then I just kind of fell into graphic design. I didn't realize there was this field that, like, somebody has to design all this stuff that's around us, all these papers and then websites and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And it just, like, amazed me. They're like, wow, I could, you know, basically draw pictures and get paid for it, and not have to be a gallery, you know, rise that whole, you know. In like a commercial way, I could be, and it'd still be art, you know, and still be, you know, beautiful and fun. So on that note, let's talk more about your sketches. You keep these immaculate sketchbooks of, you know, you like hanging out in the airport and, you know, like drawing, you know, outside the airplane window and watercolors and beautiful calligraphy and a lot of this is just for your own personal creativity and like. That's the part that's really amazing to me is you mentioned in your talk that some of these sketches you haven't really shown until like the last few years and you've been doing them for so long, and they really are beautiful. I mean, I was doing, you know, nowadays people do these kinds of things, they'll tweet them every night or Instagram because they're trying to, you know, make themselves known and shown what they can do, and obviously you don't really need to prove yourself, you know, probably, but I do that too where I'm trying to draw pictures on a regular basis, but I have to share them, you know, because I want people to see what I can do because I want to do more of that kind of work, you know. I'm not there yet. You know, I'd love to just draw pictures and get paid for it, you know, but, you know, sometimes I got to code and sometimes I got to do, other things. So I'm just, tell me more about that, you know. Tell me more, how did that all start, and have you always done that, never stopped? Tell me about your sketching.
The sketchbooks came along. I had started my design career in Houston and stayed there until 1973 and then came to Minneapolis. But once I became a partner in a design firm and started really, I think, finding the kind of the mainstream of graphic design and getting clients and getting some success in terms of getting new business and continuing to grow and build a firm and things like that, then I realized I did not have any time to personally draw anymore. And so I had started when I started in the 60s as a designer. In those days in Houston, designers were hired for draftsmanship skills. So in other words, drawing was highly sought after if you had that skill set, because this was way before computers.
All the computer art, yeah.
And it was also when we were required to kind of not only render headlines and things like that accurately and certain typefaces and whatever, so you basically, you know, you were sought after if you had draftsmanship skills on top of whatever education you had toward the design profession. So what changed for me was when I got to Minneapolis was the more success I achieved as a designer and then as a partner and then with my own firm, the more I had to farm out illustration. So, and I knew that I just didn't have time to try to devote serious time. It's a little bit like the music thing we're talking about. I just didn't have time to devote serious time to drawing. on a project.
And you're a very meticulous person too, so it's not like you're going to just crank something out overnight.
Yeah,
you know,
you
want to spend the time. I mean, there's some detailed. If you go to Eric's website, is it eMadsen?
EricMadsen.com.
You can see some of these. He has some tools up there that he's drawn and then painted as well.
Watercolor
on top.
Graphite watercolor.
It's photorealism, really. I mean, it's amazing the detail on this stuff. And I doubt that just happened over like a, you know, on a napkin over lunch or something.
You're right, Ben. No.
That wasn't a Citibank sketch or whatever.
No.
You know?
No.
So but I can imagine.
Yeah. And then where I was going with your question was that what happened for me was in the 70s when I started getting more and more out of town business and or maybe art directing photography or traveling to printers out of town or whatever, was I was starting to fly so much. And it hit me one time on a flight. I was sitting there for probably a couple hours, and I didn't own a sketchbook at that point, and I thought,
really?
Boy. I remember going through my bag, and I found some paper, and I just started kind of doodling or something like that. I may have been actually thinking about a project or something, but the next flight, before that flight, I bought a sketchbook, and then I started drawing. And then, because I was traveling so much, and then I did that for 40 years, I found that that was really the only time I had to draw. Mm. Because during the normal work day with employees and whatever, I was managing the firm, I was running a graphic design firm, and any kind of art or illustration was obviously something that I would be farming out to illustrators all over the country or whatever. So the sketchbooks became my way to kind of reconnect with that kind of that art bug that you and I both had when we were young.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, 40 years of that, you fill up a lot of books. And so it did become somewhat thematic, because a lot of it ended up taking on kind of a travel kind of, mm-hmm. you know, theme. As you saw in the presentation. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, but it was a way, it's like you were talking about trying, you come home and you sit down at that piano or you pick up your guitar like I do, mm-hmm. and it was a way for me to keep that muscle memory alive and that hand-eye, that thing that we don't want to lose touch with. And
and like you mentioned a second ago, it keeps you in touch with that childhood creativity and that imagination.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that can get... I was having some conversations with some other people at a conference last couple of days, and I find a lot of us are finding that anything that can get us in touch with that, the imagination of your childhood is great. You know, so for some people that's like, you know, collecting Legos again, or, you know, or whatever, things like that.
Yeah.
Like, or like recently bought my younger brother some Lego sets and was building them with him, and I'm like, yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? You know? So it's things like that that like just get you into that mindset that like takes you back, and
exactly.
and so drawing does that for me for sure.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, well, we share that. I mean, and it's just something. It's a little bit like our connection with the guitar and music, or you know, and it's just there is just some incredible, you know, power to that. Is keeping mm-hmm. that alive, and so these sketchbooks became a way for me to keep. To kind of keep that flame burning, and then later the tools you mentioned actually were the result of being kind of pushed, you know, by my great friend, you know, Dougal Sturmer. And
talk a little bit about him.
Yeah, he was a guy that our paths crossed over 30 some years ago, and
is his name really Dougal?
Dougal.
Dougal Sturmer.
Yeah, yeah. He still has a website up, even
really?
Though he's passed away. Yeah, and but we became lifelong friends, like brothers actually, for over 30 years, and he knew I loved to draw, And we shared a love of the West. We shared a love of
guitars.
We both collected Martin guitars. Luckily for me, he was a lefty and not a righty, so we didn't fight over any guitars. But one of the things that he left me, and you know, sadly he's gone now, but one of the things he left me was his insistence that I resume my drawing in a serious way.
Good for him.
Yeah, so he hammered away and hammered away at me, but it wasn't until about 6 years ago that I finally caved in and started doing that initial series on tools that you referenced just a moment ago, and which is a series of 21 tools. That
oh, that many?
Yeah, 21 of my late father-in-law's tools. And but it was Dougal who really, he kind of pushed me and pushed me and pushed me. I spent so much time in San Francisco in his offices, and I'd watch him work, and we would talk about it on our annual jaunts to Cody, Wyoming, and the Cowboy Music Festival and things like that. And wherever we would meet, and we tried to meet, you know, as many times a year as we could, just to get together, and you know, whether it was looking for cowboy boots or guitars or something, you know. So,
are you wearing cowboy boots?
No, I was going to, Ben, but you know, surprisingly, they're not very warm. I've discovered in Minnesota. Yeah,
I've never worn any. I wear a size 15 wide, and it's very hard.
You gotta have custom made boots.
Yeah,
though.
I can't afford custom made boots at this point in my career.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, we, you know, it was really. I think he just kind of said, you know, when are you going to get... In fact, he was after me to actually move to San Francisco and share his office space with him. But he said, when are you going to get serious about your drawing again? So,
Isn't it great when friends push us?
Well, yeah. You know.
You know, it is really... It's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know? And the best friends don't think that it's intruding. They know what's in you, and they just push it out of you. And what a blessing that is when that comes.
Well, to
across.
Be pushed by somebody like Dougal Sturmer, and I'm sure most of your audience listening knows who he is and what his work is, and or you know his body of work is legendary. And you know his obituary was written by Steve Heller in the New York Times. I mean, he's you know Milton Glaser and Brad Holland, Kid Heinrichs, you know, Aunt Steve Heller. The list is so, so long of the people that, you know, that he...
Most of the guys have been on our podcast, besides Milton Glaser.
Yeah, and the people that were all his friends and his peers and who respected his work and, you know, and to be pushed by a guy like that, even though he was my closest friend for 30 years, is like a gift. And thanks to him, I decided to really get serious about it again and devote the time it takes. And it's a little bit, I suppose, like woodshedding. If you wanted to be a real great guitarist, you know, you've got to kind of go away and work and work and work and work. Well, I kind of decided I'm gonna carve out the time and really devote to doing it. And what was fun for me was that our drawing styles are... and our approaches were so similar because we could kind of share that too, you know. Establish the drawing in graphite first, completely get the values all established, the lights and darks, and get the composition done. And then
I love to just watch you work.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And then fix it, you know, with fixative, and then apply watercolor over it, you know. And whether it's in his case, he did it more in a wash style, and my case, it was more almost a dry brush style, you know, more, I would call it, more surgical, as I showed in my slides.
The brushes that Eric uses on this stuff are just itty bitty, like microscopic.
Three hairs.
Babe. Yeah, there
three
you
hairs,
go. Three
yeah.
tiny little
yeah,
hairs.
Yeah, three tiny hairs.
Baby horse hairs.
Yeah, baby, right. Baby sable hairs.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no, and so you did the 21 tools. Are you on a new series now, or you have some other things you're
working
on?
I'm working on, of course, your audience can't see this, but you saw it in the slideshow. I'm starting to work on a series of new pieces that are somewhat related to the material you saw in the slide presentation, which is kind of combines my love of calligraphy and kind of ephemera and postage and all that kind of stuff. I'm doing a series right now on that, and hope to get a body of work, at least enough together to maybe have a show of that, like I did with the Tool Drawings.
Awesome.
You know, so yeah.
That's neat. Was that pretty cool to have your own show like that?
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah. Had you done that before?
Never had.
See,
never.
That's cool.
Had.
And that's not. Yeah, that's not like graphic design. You know.
No,
you
it
don't
was
always
so,
have a show.
Yeah. Well, it was just different. It was. I don't know. It was so.
It's fine art. I mean, really.
Well, it is, and I think that there was just this other component to it as well, Ben. I think it was the feeling that seeing a whole body of work up on a wall like that at one time, and then having the gallery just inundated with people when that opening, and in fact, Dougal flew out from San Francisco and surprised me at the opening, which was just a tremendous. Absolutely tremendous
thrill.
That
had to be the best part for
yeah
you.
It was
yeah.
just yeah absolutely totally you know he and my daughter had kind of secretly teamed up and figured this out, but she walked in on his arm that night, and it was great. But yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was really, really nice. And I think I hadn't felt the feeling I felt that night, Ben, since nights when Ron and I would play a coffee house and people would applaud. You know,
really?
We don't get a lot of applause
no,
as graphic
it's
designers.
That's different than the music world.
It is, isn't
that's
it?
That's true. Unless you come speak at design camp.
Yeah.
Then you get standing ovations and people crying and wanting you on their podcast
well,
and all this,
I'll tell you,
mushy stuff.
You guys were very generous to me, I'll say that. But I just remember that night so well because what resonated with me standing there, because over 300 and some people showed up at the gallery. It was mobbed, and I was just blown away. But I flash back to some of those concerts that we used to do at coffee houses where it would be, you know, there might be a couple hundred people in the audience or something, and then after a song, they applaud, you know, and
just wanted to say you did great the other day. Really enjoyed the presentation.
Thank you so much.
See,
oh my
listeners,
God.
I told you. She's probably crying right now.
No, yeah. That's what I'm going to remember. You're the guy that
precious.
Made everybody cry. I even cried myself. But anyway, I think you can share that because you're a musician, but I just feel, I felt that night, it just reminded me that, of that feeling, because over my design career, other than a client say, hey, we really like that, you know, but it's not.
It doesn't always happen.
You know, it doesn't always happen.
If you got a good client, it does.
You
but.
Know, but you don't get that
recognition.
That instant.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder the Stones are still considering another tour, you know? I mean, why not? Look at Paul McCartney, still trying to, you know?
Keeping it together.
I know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. Paul Simon.
Yeah.
I don't know what Art Garfunkel is doing these days, but
I'm
sure he's doing something.
Great article in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
Recent Rolling Stone. He had all of his problems with his vocal cords.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
He's now back.
Oh, he is? Oh,
he's now back. His voice is coming back. And it was a wonderful article in Rolling Stone.
Oh, I love it. We could talk about music all night.
Yeah,
maybe we will. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh.
But that was kind of great to hear that he's... the problems he had with his vocal cord issue are maybe hopefully behind him, because what a magical voice.
Oh, I mean, I think Art's wonderful. You know, I know that he kind of gets, you know, tossed aside because he's hanging around the genius of Paul, you know, Simon. That's got to be tough, you know. But, I mean, he really does have a nice thing going on. One of my favorite songs is actually the song Bright Eyes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and not the band Bright Eyes from Omaha that everybody. You know.
Oh, you have a band called.
Yeah, it's a yeah. But anyways, Bright Eyes. I just think it's a great tune, and I love Art.
What a great guy!
What a great guy!
Yeah,
Eric, we're gonna have to wrap this thing up at some point. But I am so thankful that you took the time to do this, and it's just fun to talk music and drawing and
it
all this with you.
Yeah,
and just to hear more of your story.
Thanks.
You know, it really is encouraging, because I really do think that, I mean, everyone has a story, so anyone can relate to this kind of stuff.
Yep.
So you know, whether they play guitar or even know who John Denver or Dutchendorf or whoever is. So I really thank you for sharing
the
story.
Welcome.
tonight, Eric.
You're welcome. I'm honored. Thank you.
We're shaking hands again.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you for listening to The Reflex Blue Show. For more information, visit 36point.com. The Reflex Blue Show was created by Donovan Beery and Nate Voss.